See, they claim that we were noble because our ancestors supported the Lord Ruler before the Ascension. But that means that we were privileged because of what other people had done. Not really fair, eh? Vin shrugged.
Fair as anything, I guess.
But didn't you get angry? Elend said. Didn't it frustrate you that the nobility had so much while you had so little?
I didn't think about it, Vin said. The nobility had a lot, so we could take it from them. Why should I care how they got it? Sometimes when I had food, other thieves beat me and took it. What did it matter how I got my food? It was still taken from me.
Elend paused. You know, sometimes I wonder what the political theorists I've read would say if they met you. I have a feeling they'd throw up their hands in frustration. She poked him in the side.
Enough politics. Tell me about the deepness.
Well, I think it was a creature of some sort, a dark and evil thing that nearly destroyed the world. The Lord Ruler traveled to the Well of Ascension, where he was given the power to defeat the deepness and unite mankind. There are several statues in the city depicting the event. Vin frowned.
Yes, but they never really show what the deepness looked like. It's depicted as a twisted lump at the Lord Ruler's feet.
Well, the last person who actually saw the deepness died a year ago, so I guess we'll have to make do with the statues.
Unless it comes back, Vin said quietly.
Elend frowned, looking at her again. Is that what this is about, Vin? His face softened slightly. Two armies aren't enough. You have to worry about the fate of the world as well. Vin glanced down sheepishly, and Elend laughed, pulling her close.
Ah, Vin. I know you're a bit paranoid. Honestly, considering our situation, I'm starting to feel the same. But I think this is one problem you don't have to worry about. I haven't heard any reports of monstrous incarnations of evil rampaging the land.
Vin nodded, and Elend leaned back a bit, obviously assuming that he'd answered her question.
The Hero of Ages traveled to the Well of Ascension to defeat the deepness, she thought. But the prophecies all said that the hero shouldn't take the well's power for himself. He was supposed to give it. Trust in the power itself to destroy the deepness. Rashik didn't do that. He took the power for himself. Wouldn't that mean that the deepness was never defeated? Why then wasn't the world destroyed?
The red sun and brown plants, Vin said. Did the deepness do that?
Still thinking about that? Elend frowned. Red sun and brown plants? What other colors would they be?
Kelsier said that the sun was once yellow, and plants were green.
That's an odd image.
Says it agrees with Kelsier, Vin said. The legends all say that during the early days of the Lord Ruler, the sun changed colors and ash began to fall from the skies.
Well, Elend said, I guess the deepness could have had something to do with it. I don't know, honestly. He sat musingly for a few moments. Green plants? Why not purple or blue? So odd.
The Hero of Ages traveled north, to the Well of Ascension, Vin thought again.
She turned slightly, her eyes drawn toward the terrace mountains so far away. Was it still up there? The Well of Ascension? Did you have any luck getting information out of Orsir? Elend asked. Anything to help us find the spy? Vin shrugged.
He told me that Chandra can't use allomancy.
So you can find our impostor that way? Elend said, perking up.
Maybe, Vin said. I can test Spook and Ham at least. Regular people will be more difficult. Though Chandra can't be soothed, so maybe that will let me find the spy.
That sounds promising, Elend said.
Vin nodded.
The thief in her, the paranoid girl that Elend always teased, itched to use allomancy on him, to test him to see if he reacted to her pushes and pulls.
She stopped herself. This one man she would trust. The others she would test, but she would not question Elland. In a way, she'd rather trust him and be wrong than deal with the worry of mistrust.
"I finally understand," she thought with a start. "Kelsier, I understand what it was like for you with Mare. I won't make your same mistake."
Elland was looking at her.
"What?"
she asked. "You're smiling," he said. "Do I get to hear the joke?" She hugged him.
"No,"
she said simply. Elland smiled. "All right, then. You can test Spook and Ham, but I'm pretty sure the imposter isn't one of the crew. I talked to them all day, and they were all themselves. We need to search the palace staff."
"He doesn't know how good Chandra can be."
The enemy Chandra had probably studied his victim for months and months, learning and memorizing their every mannerism. "I've spoken to Ham and Damu," Elland said. "As members of the palace guard, they know about the bones, and Ham was able to guess what they were. Hopefully they can sort through the staff with minimal disturbance and locate the imposter." Vin's senses itched at how trusting Elland was.
"No," she thought. "Let him assume the best. He has enough to worry about. Besides, perhaps the Chandra is imitating someone outside our core team. Elland can search that avenue. And if the imposter is a member of the crew, well, that's the sort of situation where my paranoia comes in handy."
"Anyway," Elland said, standing, "I have a few things to check on before it gets too late." Vin nodded. He gave her a long kiss, then left. She sat on the table for a few moments longer, not looking at the massive rose window, but at the smaller window to the side, which she'd left slightly open. It stood, a doorway into the night. Mist churned in the blackness, tentatively sending tendrils into the room, evaporating quietly in the warmth.
"I will not fear you," Vin whispered, "and I will find your secret."
She climbed off the table and slipped out the window, back out to meet with Orsur, and do another check of the palace grounds.
"I had determined that Elendi was the hero of ages, and I intended to prove it. I should have bowed before the will of the others. I shouldn't have insisted on traveling with Elendi to witness his journeys. It was inevitable that Elendi himself would find out what I believed him to be."
15. On the eighth day out of the conventicle, Sazed awoke to find himself alone. He stood, pushing off his blanket and the light film of ash that had fallen during the night. Marsh's place beneath the tree's canopy was empty, though a patch of bare earth indicated where the Inquisitor had slept. Sazed stood, following Marsh's footsteps out into the harsh red sunlight. The ash was deeper here, without the cover of trees, and there was also more wind blowing it into drifts. Sazed regarded the windswept landscape. There was no further sign of Marsh. Sazed returned to camp. The trees here, in the middle of the eastern dominance, rose twisted and knotted, but they had shelf-like overlapping branches, thick with brown needles. These provided decent shelter, though the ash seemed capable of infiltrating any sanctuary. Sazed made a simple soup for breakfast. Marsh did not return. Sazed washed his brown travel robes in a nearby stream. Marsh did not return. Sazed sewed a rent in his sleeve, oiled his walking boots, and shaved his head. Marsh did not return. Sazed got out the rubbing he'd made in the conventicle, transcribed a few words, then forced himself to put the sheet away. He worried about blurring the words by opening it too often or by getting ash on it. Better to wait until he could have a proper desk and clean room. Marsh did not return. Finally, Sazed left. He couldn't define the sense of urgency that he felt, part excitement to share what he had learned, part desire to see how Vin and the young King Elland Venture were handling events in Luthadel. Marsh knew the way. He would catch up. Sazed raised his hand, shading his eyes against the red sunlight, looking down from his hilltop vantage. There was a slight darkness on the horizon, to the east of the main road. He tapped his geography coppermind, seeking out descriptions of the eastern dominance. The knowledge swelled his mind, blessing him with recollection. The darkness was a village named Urbene. He searched through one of his indexes, looking for the right gazetteer. The index was growing fuzzy, its information difficult to remember, which meant that he'd switched it from coppermind to memory and back too many times. Knowledge inside a coppermind would remain pristine, but anything inside his head, even for only a few moments, would decay. He'd have to rememorize the index later. He found what he was looking for and dumped the right memories into his head. The gazetteer listed Urbana as picturesque, which probably meant that some important nobleman had decided to make his manor there. The listing said that the ska of Urbana were herdsmen. Sazed scribbled a note to himself, then redeposited the gazetteer's memories. Reading the note told him what he had just forgotten. Like the index, the gazetteer memories had inevitably decayed slightly during their stay in his head. Fortunately, he had a second set of coppermines hidden back up in Terrace, and would use those to pass his knowledge on to another keeper. His current coppermines were for everyday use. Unapplied knowledge benefited no one. He shouldered his pack. A visit to the village would do him some good, even if it slowed him down. His stomach agreed with the decision. It was unlikely the peasants would have much in the way of food, but perhaps they would be able to provide something other than broth. Besides, they might have news of events at Luthadel. He hiked down the short hill, taking the smaller eastern fork in the road. Once, there had been little travel in the final empire. The Lord Ruler had forbidden ska to leave their indentured lands, and only thieves and rebels had dared disobey. Still, most of the nobility had made their livings by trading, so a village such as this one might be accustomed to visitors. Sazed began to notice the oddities immediately. Goats roamed the countryside along the road, unwatched. Sazed paused, then dug a coppermine from his pack. He searched through it as he walked. One book on husbandry claimed that herdsmen sometimes left their flocks alone to graze. Yet the unwatched animals made him nervous. He quickened his pace. "Just to the south, the ska starve," he thought. "Yet here, livestock is so plentiful that nobody can be spared to keep it safe from bandits and predators." The small village appeared in the distance. Sazed could almost convince himself that the lack of activity, the lack of movement in the streets, the derelict doors and shutters swinging in the breeze, was due to his approach. Perhaps the people were so scared that they were hiding. Or perhaps they simply were all out, tending flocks. Sazed stopped. A shift in the wind brought a telltale scent from the village. The ska weren't hiding, and they hadn't fled. It was the scent of rotting bodies. Suddenly urgent, Sazed pulled out a small ring, a scent tin mined, and slipped it on his thumb. The smell on the wind, it didn't seem like that of a slaughter. It was a mustier, dirtier smell. A smell not only of death, but of corruption, unwashed bodies, and waste. He reversed the use of the tin mind, filling it instead of tapping it, and his ability to smell grew very weak, keeping him from gagging. He continued on, carefully entering the village proper. Like most ska villages, Urbene was organized simply. It had a group of 10 large hovels built in a loose circle, with a well at the center. The buildings were wood, and for thatching they used the same needle-bearing branches from the trees he'd seen. Overseers' huts, along with a fine nobleman's manor, stood a little farther up the valley. If it hadn't been for the smell, and the sense of haunted emptiness, Sazed might have agreed with his gazetteer's description of Urbene. For ska residences, the hovels looked well-maintained, and the village lay in a quiet hollow amid the rising landscape. It wasn't until he got a little closer that he found the first bodies. They lay scattered around the doorway to the nearest hovel, about a half dozen of them. Sazed approached carefully, but could quickly see that the corpses were at least several days old. He knelt beside the first one, that of a woman, and could see no visible cause of death. The others were the same. Nervous, Sazed forced himself to reach up and pull open the door to the hovel. The stench from inside was so strong that he could smell it through his tin mind. The hovel, like most, was only a single chamber. It was filled with bodies. Most lay wrapped in thin blankets, some sat with backs pressed up against the walls, rotting heads hanging limply from their necks. They had gaunt, nearly fleshless bodies, with withered limbs and protruding ribs. Haunted, unseeing eyes sat in desiccated faces. These people had died of starvation and dehydration. Sazed stumbled from the hovel, head bowed. He didn't expect to find anything different in the other buildings, but he checked anyway. He saw the same scene repeated again and again. Woundless corpses on the ground outside, many more bodies huddled inside. Flies buzzing about in swarms, covering faces. In several of the buildings he found gnawed human bones at the center of the room. He stumbled out of the final hovel, breathing deeply through his mouth. Dozens of people, over 100 total, dead for no obvious reason. What possibly could have caused so many of them to simply sit, hidden in their houses, while they ran out of food and water? How could they have starved when there were beasts running free? And what had killed those that he'd found outside, lying in the ash? They didn't seem as emaciated as the ones inside, though from the level of decomposition it was hard to tell. "I must be mistaken about the starvation," Sazed told himself. "It must have been a plague of some sort. A disease." "That is a much more logical explanation." He searched through his medical copper mind. Surely there were diseases that could strike quickly, leaving their victims weakened, and the survivors must have fled, leaving behind their loved ones, not taking any of the animals from their pastures. Sazed frowned. At that moment, he thought he heard something. He spun, drawing auditory power from his hearing tin mind. The sounds were there, the sound of breathing, the sound of movement, coming from one of the hovels he'd visited. He dashed forward, throwing open the door, looking again on the sorry dead. The corpses lay where they had been before. Sazed studied them very carefully, this time watching until he found the one whose chest was moving. "By the forgotten gods," Sazed thought. The man didn't need to work hard to feign death. His hair had fallen out, and his eyes were sunken into his face. Though he didn't look particularly starved, Sazed must have missed seeing him because of his dirty, almost corpse-like body. Sazed stepped toward the man. "I am a friend," he said quietly. The man remained motionless. Sazed frowned as he walked forward and laid a hand on the man's shoulder. The man's eyes snapped open, and he cried out, jumping to his feet. Dazed and frenzied, he scrambled over corpses, moving to the back of the room. He huddled down, staring at Sazed. "Please," Sazed said, setting down his pack. "You mustn't be afraid." The only food he had besides broth spices was a few handfuls of meal, but he pulled some out. "I have food." The man shook his head. "There is no food," he whispered. "We ate it all, except the food." His eyes darted toward the center of the room, toward the bones Sazed had noticed earlier. Uncooked, gnawed on, placed in a pile beneath a ragged cloth as if to hide them. "I didn't eat the food," the man whispered. "I know," Sazed said, taking a step forward. "But there is other food. Outside." "Can't go outside." "Why not?" The man paused, then looked down. "Mist." Sazed glanced toward the doorway. The sun was nearing the horizon, but wouldn't set for another hour or so. There was no mist. Not now, anyway. Sazed felt a chill. He slowly turned back toward the man.
Mist during the day?
The man nodded.
And it stayed? Sazed asked. It didn't go away after a few hours?
The man shook his head.
Days? Weeks? All mist. Lord Ruler,
Sazed thought, then caught himself. It had been a long time since he'd sworn by that creature's name, even in his thoughts. But for the mist to come during the day, then to stay, if this man were to be believed, for weeks. Sazed could imagine the Ska, frightened in their hovels, 1,000 years of terror, tradition, and superstition keeping them from venturing outside. But to remain inside until they starved? Even their fear of the mist, deep-seated though it was, wouldn't have been enough to make them starve themselves to death, would it?
Why didn't you leave? Sazed asked quietly. Some did,
the man said, nodding as if to himself.
Jell. You know what happened to him?
Sazed frowned.
Dead? Taken by the mist. Oh, how he shook. Was a bull-headed one, you know, old Jell. Oh, how he shook. How he writhed when it took him.
Sazed closed his eyes.
The corpses I found outside the doors. Some got away,
the man said. Sazed snapped his eyes open.
What?
The crazed villager nodded again.
Some got away, you know. They called to us after leaving the village. Said it was all right. It didn't take them. Don't know why. It killed others, though. Some it shook to the ground, but they got up later. Some it killed.
The mist let some survive, but it killed others? The man didn't answer. He'd sat down, and now he lay back, staring unfocused at the ceiling.
Please, Sazed said. You must answer me. Who did it kill, and who did it let pass? What is the connection?
The man turned toward him.
Time for food,
he said, then rose. He wandered over to a corpse, then pulled on an arm, ripping the rotted meat free. It was easy to see why he hadn't starved to death like the others. Sazed pushed aside nausea, striding across the room and grabbing the man's arm as he raised the near-fleshless bone to his lips. The man froze, then looked up at Sazed.
It's not mine,
he yelped, dropping the bone and running to the back of the room. Sazed stood for a moment.
I must hurry. I must get to Luthadel. There is more wrong with this world than bandits and armies.
The wild man watched with a feral sort of terror as Sazed picked up his pack, then paused and set it down again. He pulled out his largest pewter mind. He fastened the wide metal bracer to his forearm, then turned and walked toward the villager.
No!
The man screamed, trying to dash to the side. Sazed tapped the pewter mind, pulling out a burst of strength. He felt his muscles enlarge, his robes growing tight. He snatched the villager as the man ran past, then held him out, far enough away that the man couldn't do either of them much harm. Then he carried the man outside of the building. The man stopped struggling as soon as they emerged into the sunlight. He looked up, as if seeing the sun for the first time. Sazed set him down, then released his pewter mind. The man knelt, looking up at the sun, then turned to Sazed.
The Lord Ruler! Why did he abandon us? Why did he go? The Lord Ruler was a tyrant.
The man shook his head.
He loved us. He ruled us. Now that he's gone, the mists can kill us. They hate us.
Then, surprisingly adroit, the man leaped to his feet and scrambled down the pathway out of the village. Sazed took a step forward but paused. What would he do? pulled the man all the way to Luthadel? There was water in the well, and there were animals to eat. Sazed could only hope that the poor wretch would be able to manage. Sighing, Sazed returned to the hovel and retrieved his pack. On his way out, he paused, then pulled out one of his steel mines. Steel held one of the very most difficult attributes to store up, physical speed. He had spent months filling this particular steel mine in preparation for the possibility that someday he might need to run somewhere very, very quickly. He put it on now.
Yes, he was the one who fueled the rumors after that. I could never have done what he himself did, convincing and persuading the world that he was indeed the hero. I don't know if he himself believed it, but he made others think that he must be the one.
16. Vin rarely used her quarters. Elland had assigned her spacious rooms, which was perhaps part of the problem. She'd spent her childhood sleeping in nooks, lairs, or alleys. Having three separate chambers was a bit daunting. It didn't really matter, however. During her time awake, she was with either Elland or the Mists. Her rooms existed for her to sleep in, or in this case, for her to make a mess in. She sat on the floor in the center of her main chamber. Elland's steward, concerned that Vin didn't have any furniture, had insisted on decorating her rooms. This morning, Vin had pushed some of this aside, bunching up rugs and chairs on one side so that she could sit on the cool stones with her book. It was the first real book she had ever owned, though it was just a collection of pages bound loosely at one side. That suited her just fine. The simple binding had made the book that much easier to pull apart. She sat amid stacks of paper. It was amazing how many pages there were in the book, once she had separated them. Vin sat next to one pile, looking over its contents. She shook her head, then crawled over to another pile. She leafed through the pages, eventually selecting one. "Sometimes I wonder if I'm going mad," the words read. "Perhaps it is due to the pressure of knowing that I must somehow bear the burden of an entire world. Perhaps it is caused by the death I have seen, the friends I have lost, the friends I have been forced to kill. Either way, I sometimes see shadows following me, dark creatures that I don't understand, nor do I wish to understand. They are perhaps some figment of my overtaxed mind?" Vin sat for a moment rereading the paragraphs. Then she moved the sheet over to another pile. Orsieur lay on the side of the room, head on paws, eyeing her. "Mistress," he said, as she set down the page, "I have been watching you work for the last 2 hours, and will admit that I am thoroughly confused. What is the point of all this?" Vin crawled over to another stack of pages. "I thought you didn't care how I spent my time."
"I don't," Orsieur said, "but I do get bored."
"And annoyed, apparently."
"I like to understand what is going on around me."
Vin shrugged, gesturing toward the stacks of paper. "This is the Lord Ruler's logbook. Well, actually, it's not the logbook of the Lord Ruler we knew, but the logbook of the man who should have been the Lord Ruler."
"Should have been?" Orsier asked. "You mean he should have conquered the world, but didn't?"
"No," Vin said. "I mean he should have been the one who took the power at the Well of Ascension. This man, the man who wrote this book, we don't actually know his name, was some kind of prophesied hero. Or, everyone thought he was. Anyway, the man who became the Lord Ruler, Rashik, was this hero's pack-man. Don't you remember us talking about this, back when you were imitating Renu?" Orsier nodded.
"I recall you briefly mentioning it."
"Well, this is the book Kelsier and I found when we infiltrated the Lord Ruler's palace. We thought it was written by the Lord Ruler, but it turns out it was written by the man the Lord Ruler killed, the man whose place he took."
"Yes, mistress," Orsier said. "Now why exactly are you tearing it to pieces?"
"I'm not," Vin said. "I just took off the binding so I could move the pages around. It helps me think.
I see, Horsier said. And what exactly are you looking for? The Lord Ruler is dead, mistress. Last I checked, you killed him.
What am I looking for? Vin thought, picking up another page. Ghosts in the mist. She read the words on this page slowly. It isn't a shadow. The dark thing that follows me, the thing that only I can see. It isn't really a shadow. It is blackish and translucent, but it doesn't have a shadow-like solid outline. It's insubstantial, wispy and formless, like it's made out of black fog. Or mist, perhaps. Vin lowered the page. It watched him, too, she thought. She remembered reading the words over a year before, thinking that the hero must have started to go mad. With all the pressures on him, who would have been surprised? Now, however, she thought she understood the nameless logbook author better. She knew he was not the Lord Ruler, and could see him for what he might have been. Uncertain of his place in the world, but forced into important events. Determined to do the best he could. Idealistic, in a way. And the mist spirit had chased him. What did it mean? What did seeing it imply for her? She crawled over to another pile of pages. She'd spent the morning scanning through the logbook for clues about the mist creature. However, she was having trouble digging out much beyond these two familiar passages. She made piles of pages that mentioned anything strange or supernatural. She made a small pile with pages that referenced the mist spirit. She also had a special pile for references to the deepness. This last one, ironically, was both the largest and least informative of the group. The logbook author had a habit of mentioning the deepness, but not saying much about it. The deepness was dangerous, that much was clear. It had ravaged the land, slaying thousands. The monster had sown chaos wherever it stepped, bringing destruction and fear, but the armies of mankind had been unable to defeat it. Only the Terrace prophecies and the Hero of Ages had offered any hope. If only he had been more specific, Vin thought with frustration, riffling papers. However, the tone of the logbook really was more melancholy than it was informative. It was something that the hero had written for himself, to stay sane, to let him put his fears and hopes down on paper. Elland said he wrote for similar reasons sometimes. To Vin it seemed a silly method of dealing with problems. With a sigh, she turned to the last stack of papers, the one with pages she had yet to study. She lay down on the stone floor and began to read, searching for useful information. It took time. Not only was she a slow reader, but her mind kept wandering. She'd read the logbook before, and oddly, hints and phrases from it reminded her of where she'd been at the time. 2 years and a world away in Felize, still recovering from her near death at the hands of a steel inquisitor, she'd been forced to spend her days pretending to be Valette Renu, a young, inexperienced country noblewoman. Back then, she still hadn't believed in Kelsier's plan to overthrow the final empire. She'd stayed with the crew because she valued the strange things they offered her. Friendship, trust, and lessons in allomancy. Not because she accepted their goals. She would never have guessed where that would lead her. To balls and parties, to actually growing, just a bit, to become the noblewoman she had pretended to be. But that had been a farce. A few months of make-believe. She forced her thoughts away from the frilly clothing and the dances. She needed to focus on practical matters. And is this practical? She thought idly, setting a page in one of the stacks. Studying things I barely comprehend? Fearing a threat nobody else even cares to notice? She sighed, folding her arms under her chin as she lay on her stomach. What was she really worried about? That the deepness would return? All she had were a few phantom visions in the mist, things that could, as Elland implied, have easily been fabricated by her overworked mind. More important was another question. Assuming that the deepness was real, what did she expect to do about it? She was no hero, general, or leader. Oh, Kelsier, she thought, picking up another page. We could use you now. Kelsier had been a man beyond convention, a man who had somehow been able to defy reality. He'd thought that by giving his life to overthrow the Lord Ruler, he would secure freedom for the Ska. But what if his sacrifice had opened the way for a greater danger? Something so destructive that the Lord Ruler's oppression was a preferable alternative. She finally finished the page, then placed it in the stack of those that contained no useful information. Then she paused. She couldn't even remember what she'd just read. She sighed, picking the page back up, looking at it again. How did Elland do it? He could study the same books over and over again. But for Vin, it was hard to... She paused. I must assume that I am not mad, the words said. I cannot, with any rational sense of confidence, continue my quest if I do not believe this. The thing following me must, therefore, be real. She sat up. She only vaguely remembered this section of the logbook. The book was organized like a diary, with sequential but dateless entries. It had a tendency to ramble, and the hero had been fond of droning on about his insecurities. This section had been particularly dry. But there, in the middle of his complaining, was a tidbit of information. I believe that it would kill me if it could, the text continued. There is an evil to the thing of shadow and fog, and my skin recoils at its touch. Yet it seems limited in what it can do, especially to me. It can affect this world, however. The knife it placed in Fedek's chest proves that much. I'm still not certain which was more traumatic for him, the wound itself or seeing the thing that did it to him. Rashik whispers that I stabbed Fedek myself, for only Fedek and I can give witness to that night's events. However, I must make a decision. I must determine that I am not mad. The alternative is to admit that it was I who held that knife. Somehow, knowing Rashik's opinion on the matter makes it much easier for me to believe the opposite. The next page continued on about Rashik, and the next several entries contained no mention of the Mist Spirit. However, Vin found even these few paragraphs exciting. He made a decision, she thought. I have to make the same one. She'd never worried that she was mad, but she had sensed some logic in Ellen's words. Now she rejected them. The Mist Spirit was not some delusion brought on by a mixture of stress and memories of the logbook. It was real. That didn't mean the deepness was returning, nor did it mean that Luthadel was in any sort of supernatural danger. Both, however, were possibilities. She set this page with the two others that contained concrete information about the Mist Spirit, then turned back to her studies, determined to pay closer attention to her reading. The armies were digging in. Elland watched from atop the wall as his plan, vague though it was, began to take form. Straff was making a defensive perimeter to the north, holding the canal route back a relatively short distance to Urto, his home city and capital. Set was digging into the west of the city, holding the Luth-Davin Canal, which ran back to his cannery in Haverfrex. A cannery. That was something Elland wished he had in the city. The technology was newer, perhaps 50 years old, but he'd read of it. The scholars had considered its main use that of providing easily carried supplies for soldiers fighting at the fringes of the Empire. They hadn't considered stockpiles for sieges, particularly in Luthadel. But then, who would have? Even as Elland watched, patrols began to move out from the separate armies. Some moved to watch the boundaries between the two forces, but others moved to secure other canal routes, bridges across the river channel, and roads leading away from Luthadel. In a remarkably short time, the city felt completely surrounded. Cut off from the world, and the rest of Ellen's small kingdom. No more moving in or out. The armies were counting on disease, starvation, and other weakening factors to bring Elland to his knees. The siege of Luthadel had begun. That's a good thing, he told himself. For this plan to work, they have to think me desperate. They have to be so sure that I'm willing to side with them that they don't consider that I might be working with their enemies, too. As Elland watched, he noticed someone climbing up the steps to the wall. Clubs. The general hobbled over to Elland, who had been standing alone.
"Congratulations," Club said. "Looks like you now have a full-blown siege on your hands."
"Good.
It'll give us a little breathing room, I guess," Club said. Then he eyed Elland with one of his gnarled looks. "You'd better be up to this, kid."
"I know," Elland whispered.
"You've made yourself the focal point," Club said. "The Assembly can't break this siege until you meet officially with Straff, and the Kings aren't likely to meet with anyone on the crew other than yourself. This is all about you. Useful place for a king to be, I suppose, if he's a good one."
Clubs fell silent. Elland stood, looking out over the separate armies. The words spoken to him by Tyndall, the Terrace Woman, still bothered him.
"You are a fool, Elland Venture."
So far, neither of the kings had responded to Elland's requests for a meeting, though the crew was sure that they soon would. His enemies would wait, to make Elland sweat a bit. The Assembly had just called another meeting, probably to try and bully him into releasing them from their earlier proposal. Elland had found a convenient reason to skip the meeting. He looked at Clubs.
"And am I a good king, Clubs? In your opinion?"
The general glanced at him, and Elland saw a harsh wisdom in his eyes.
"I've known worse leaders," he said. "But I've also known a hell of a lot better."
Elland nodded slowly.
"I want to be good at this, Clubs. Nobody else is going to look after the Ska like they deserve. Set, Straff. They just make slaves of the people again. I want to be more than my ideas, though. I want to... need to... be a man that others can look to."
Clubs shrugged.
"My experience has been that the man is usually made by the situation. Kelsier was a selfish dandy until the pits nearly broke him."
He glanced at Elland.
"Will this siege be your pits of Hathsin, Elland Venture?"
"I don't know," he said honestly.
"Then we'll have to wait and see, I guess. For now, someone wants to speak with you."
He turned, nodding toward the street some 40 feet below, where a tall feminine figure stood in colorful terrace robes.
"She told me to send you down," Club said.
He paused, then glanced at Elland.
"It isn't often you meet someone who feels like they can order me around. And a terrace woman at that. I thought those terrace were all docile and kindly."
Elland smiled. "I guess Sazed spoiled us." Club snorted.
"So much for 1,000 years of breeding, eh?"
Elland nodded.
"You're sure she's safe?"
Clubs asked.
"Yes," Elland said. "Her story checks out.
Vin brought in several of the terrace people from the city, and they knew and recognized Tyndall. She's apparently a fairly important person back in her homeland. Plus, she had performed ferrochemy for him, growing stronger to free her hands. That meant she wasn't a Chondra. All of it together meant that she was trustworthy enough. Even Vin admitted that, even if she continued to dislike the Terrace Woman. Clubs nodded to him, and Elland took a deep breath. Then he walked down the stairs to meet Tyndall for another round of lessons.
"Today, we will do something about your clothing," Tyndall said, closing the door to Elland's study.
A plump seamstress with bowl-cut white hair waited inside, standing respectfully with a group of youthful assistants. Elland glanced down at his clothing. It actually wasn't bad. The suit coat and vest fit fairly well. The trousers weren't as stiff as those favored by imperial nobility, but he was king now. Shouldn't he be able to set the trends?
"I don't see what's wrong with it," he said.
He held up a hand as Tyndall began to speak.
"I know it's not quite as formal as what other men like to wear, but it suits me."
"It's disgraceful,"
Tyndall said.
"Now I hardly see..."
"Don't argue with me."
"But, see, the other day you said that..."
"Kings don't argue, Elland Venture," Tyndall said firmly. "They command. And part of your ability to command
comes from your bearing. Slovenly clothing invites other slovenly habits, such as your posture, which I've already mentioned, I believe.
Elland sighed, rolling his eyes as Tyndall snapped her fingers. The seamstress and her assistants started unpacking a pair of large trunks.
This isn't necessary, Elland said. I already have some suits that fit more snugly. I wear them on formal occasions.
You're not going to wear suits anymore, Tyndall said.
Excuse me?
Tyndall eyed him with a commanding stare, and Elland sighed.
Explain yourself, he said, trying to sound commanding.
Tyndall nodded.
You have maintained the dress code preferred by the nobility, sanctioned by the final emperor. In some respects, this was a good idea. It gave you a connection to the former government, and made you seem less of a deviant. Now, however, you are in a different position. Your people are in danger, and the time for simple diplomacy is over. You are at war. Your dress should reflect that.
The seamstress selected a particular costume, then brought it over to Elland, while the assistants set up a changing screen. Elland hesitantly accepted the costume. It was stiff and white, and the front of the jacket appeared to button all the way up to a rigid collar. All in all, it looked like a uniform, he said, frowning.
Indeed, Tyndall said. You want your people to believe that you can protect them? Well, a king isn't simply a lawmaker. He's a general. It is time you began to act like you deserve your title, Elland Venture.
I'm no warrior, Elland said. This uniform is a lie.
The first point we will soon change, Tyndall said. The second is not true. You command the armies of the Central Dominance. That makes you a military man, whether or not you know how to swing a sword. Now, go change.
Elland acceded with a shrug. He walked around the changing screen, pushed aside a stack of books to make room, then began to change. The white trousers fit snugly and fell straight around the calves. While there was a shirt, it was completely obscured by the large, stiff jacket, which had military shoulder fittings. It had an array of buttons, all of which he noticed were wood instead of metal, as well as a strange shield-like design over the right breast. It seemed to have some sort of arrow, or perhaps spear, emblazoned in it. Stiffness, cut, and design considered, Elland was surprised how well the uniform fit. It's sized quite well, he noted, putting on the belt, then pulling down the bottom of the jacket, which came all the way to his hips.
We got your measurements from your tailor, Tyndall said.
Elland stepped around the changing screen, and several assistants approached. One politely motioned for him to step into a pair of shiny black boots, and the other attached a white cape to fastenings at his shoulders. The final assistant handed him a polished hardwood dueling cane and sheath. Elland hooked it onto the belt, then pulled it through a slit in the jacket so it hung outside. That much, at least, he had done before.
Good, Tyndall said, looking him up and down. Once you learn to stand up straight, that will be a decent improvement. Now sit.
Elland opened his mouth to object, but thought better of it. He sat down, and an assistant approached to attach a sheet around his shoulders. She then pulled out a pair of shears.
Now wait, Elland said. I see where this is going.
Then voice an objection, Tyndall said. Don't be vague.
All right, then, Elland said. I like my hair.
Short hair is easier to care for than long hair, Tyndall said. And you have proven that you cannot be trusted in the area of personal grooming.
You aren't cutting my hair, Elland said firmly.
Tyndall paused, then nodded. The apprentice backed away, and Elland stood, pulling off the sheet. The seamstress produced a large mirror, and Elland walked forward to inspect himself. And froze. The difference was surprising. All his life he'd seen himself as a scholar and socialite, but also as just a bit of a fool. He was Elland, the friendly, comfortable man with the funny ideas. Easy to dismiss, perhaps, but difficult to hate. The man he saw now was no dandy of the court. He was a serious man, a formal man, a man to be taken seriously. The uniform made him want to stand up straighter, to rest one hand on the dueling cane. His hair, slightly curled, long on the top and sides, and blown loose by the wind atop the city wall, didn't fit. Elland turned.
"All right," he said. "Cut it."
Tyndall smiled, then nodded for him to sit. He did so, waiting quietly while the assistant worked. When he stood again, his head matched the suit. It wasn't extremely short, not like Ham's hair, but it was neat and precise. One of the assistants approached and handed him a loop of silver-painted wood. He turned to Tyndall, frowning.
"A crown?" he asked. "Nothing ostentatious," Tyndall said. "This is a more subtle era than some of those gone by. The crown isn't a symbol of your wealth, but of your authority. You will wear it from now on, whether you are in private or in public."
"The Lord Ruler didn't wear a crown."
"The Lord Ruler didn't need to remind people that he was in charge," Tyndall said.
Elland paused, then slipped on the crown. It bore no gemstones or ornamentation. It was just a simple coronet. As he might have expected, it fit perfectly. He turned back toward Tyndall, who waved for the seamstress to pack up and leave.
"You have 6 uniforms like this one waiting for you in your rooms," Tyndall said. "Until this siege is over, you will wear nothing else. If you want variety, change the color of the cape."
Elland nodded. Behind him, the seamstress and her assistants slipped out the door.
"Thank you," he told Tyndall. "I was hesitant at first, but you are right. This makes a difference." "Enough of one to deceive people for now, at least," Tyndall said.
"Deceive people?"
"Of course. You didn't think that was it, did you?"
"Well," Tyndall raised an eyebrow.
"A few lessons, and you think you're through? We've barely begun. You are still a fool, Elland Venture. You just don't look like one anymore. Hopefully our charade will begin reversing some of the damage you've done to your reputation. However, it's going to take a lot more training before I'll actually trust you to interact with people and not embarrass yourself."
Elland flushed.
"What do you..." He paused.
"Tell me what you plan to teach me, then."
"Well, you need to learn how to walk, for one thing."
"Something's wrong with the way I walk?"
"By the forgotten gods, yes," Tyndall said, sounding amused, though no smile marred her lips. "And your speech patterns still need work. Beyond that, of course, there is your inability to handle weapons."
"I've had some training," Elland said. "Ask Vin. I rescued her from the Lord Ruler's palace the night of the collapse."
"I know," Tyndall said. "And from what I've heard, it was a miracle you survived. Fortunately, the girl was there to do the actual fighting. You apparently rely on her quite a bit for that sort of thing."
"She's Mistborn."
"That is no excuse for your slovenly lack of skill," Tyndall said. "You cannot always rely on your woman to protect you. Not only is it embarrassing, but your people, your soldiers, will expect you to be able to fight with them. I doubt you will ever be the type of leader who can lead a charge against the enemy, but you should at least be able to handle yourself if your position gets attacked."
"So you want me to begin sparring with Vin and Ham during their training sessions?"
"Goodness, no! Can't you imagine how terrible it would be for morale if the men saw you being beaten up in public?"
Tyndall shook her head.
"No. We'll have you trained discreetly by a dueling master. Given a few months, we should have you competent with the cane and the sword. Hopefully, this little siege of yours will last that long before the fighting starts."
Elland flushed again.
"You keep talking down to me. It's like I'm not even king in your eyes. Like you see me as some kind of placeholder."
Tyndall didn't answer, but her eyes glinted with satisfaction. "You said it, not I," her expression seemed to say. Elland flushed more deeply.
You can, perhaps, learn to be a king, Elendventure, Tyndall said. Until then, you'll just have to learn to fake it.
Elend's angry response was cut off by a knock at the door. Elend gritted his teeth, turning.
Come in.
The door swung open.
There's news, Captain Demuse said, his youthful face excited as he entered.
He
froze. Elend cocked his head.
Yes?
Demu paused, looked Elend over again before continuing.
Ham sent me, Your Majesty. He says that a messenger from one of the kings has arrived.
Really? Elend said.
From Lord Set?
No, Your Majesty. The messenger is from your father.
Elend frowned.
Well, tell Ham I'll be there in a moment.
Yes, Your Majesty, Demu said, retreating. I like the new uniform, Your Majesty.
Thank you, Demu, Elend said. Do you by chance know where Lady Vin is? I haven't seen her all day.
I think she's in her quarters, Your Majesty.
Her quarters? She never stays there. Is she sick?
Do you want me to summon her? Demu asked.
No, thank you, Elend said. I'll get her. Tell Ham to make the messenger comfortable.
Demu nodded, then withdrew. Elend turned to Tyndall, who was smiling to herself with a look of satisfaction. Elend brushed by her, walking over to grab his notebook.
I'm going to learn to do more than just fake being King, Tyndall.
We'll see.
Elend shot a glance at the middle-aged terrace woman in her robes and jewelry.
Practice expressions like that one, Tyndall noted, and you just might do it.
Is that all it is, then? Elend asked. Expressions and costumes? Is that what makes a king?
Of course not.
Elend stopped by the door, turning back.
Then what does? What do you think makes a man a good king, Tyndall of Terrace?
Trust,
Tyndall said, looking him in the eyes.
A good king is one who is trusted by his people, and one who deserves that trust.
Elend paused, then nodded. Good answer, he acknowledged, then pulled open the door and rushed out to find Vin.
If only the Terrace religion and belief in the Anticipation hadn't spread beyond our people.
17. The piles of paper seemed to multiply as Vin found more and more ideas in the logbook that she wanted to isolate and remember. What were the prophecies about the Hero of Ages? How did the logbook author know where to go? And what did he think he'd have to do when he got there? Eventually, lying amid the mess, overlapping piles turned in odd directions to keep them separate, Vin acknowledged a distasteful fact. She was going to have to take notes. With a sigh, she rose and crossed the room, stepping carefully over several stacks and approaching the room's desk. She'd never used it before. In fact, she'd complained about it to Elend. What need did she have of a writing desk? So she'd thought. She selected a pen, then pulled out a little jar of ink, remembering the days when Reen had taught her to write. He'd quickly grown frustrated with her scratchings, complaining about the cost of ink and paper. He'd taught her to read so that she could decipher contracts and imitate a noblewoman. But he'd thought that writing was less useful. In general, Vin shared this opinion. Apparently, however, writing had uses even if one wasn't a scribe. Elend was always scribbling notes and memos to himself. She'd often been impressed by how quickly he could write. How did he make the letters come so easily? She grabbed a couple of blank sheets of paper and walked back over to her sorted piles. She sat down with crossed legs and unscrewed the top of the ink bottle.
Mistress, Orsure noted, still lying with his paws before him. You do realize that you just left the writing desk behind to sit on the floor.
Vin looked up.
And? The purpose of a writing desk is, well,
Writing?
But my papers are all over here.
Papers can be moved, I believe. If they prove too heavy, you could always burn pewter to give yourself more strength.
Vin eyed his amused face as she inked the nib of her pen. Well, at least he's displaying something other than his dislike of me. The floor is more comfortable.
If you say so, mistress, I will believe it to be true.
She paused, trying to determine if he was still mocking her or not. Blasted dog's face, she thought. Too hard to read. With a sigh, she leaned down and began to write out the first word. She had to make each line precisely so that the ink didn't smudge, and she had to pause often to sound out words and find the right letters. She'd barely written a couple of sentences before a knock came at her door. She looked up with a frown. Who was bothering her?
"Come in," she called.
She heard a door open in the other room, and Ellen's voice called out, "Vin?"
"In here,"
she said, turning back to her writing.
"Why did you knock?"
"Well, you might have been changing," he said, entering.
"So?"
Vin asked. Ellen chuckled.
2 years in privacy is still a strange concept to you.
Vin looked up.
"Well, I did."
For just the briefest flash of a moment, she thought he was someone else. Her instincts kicked in before her brain, and she reflexively dropped the pen, jumping up and flaring pewter. Then she stopped.
"That much of a change, eh?"
Ellen asked, holding out his arms so she could get a better look at his costume. Vin put a hand to her chest, so shocked that she stepped right on one of her stacks. It was Ellen, but it wasn't. The brilliant white costume, with its sharp lines and firm figure, looked so different from his normal loose jacket and trousers. He seemed more commanding, more regal.
"You cut your hair,"
she said, walking around him slowly, studying the costume.
"Tyndall's idea," he said. "What do you think?"
"Less for people to grab onto in a fight,"
Vin said. Ellen smiled.
"Is that all you think about?"
"No,"
Vin said absently, reaching up to tug his cape. It came free easily, and she nodded approvingly. Mist cloaks were the same. Ellen wouldn't have to worry about someone grabbing his cape in a fight. She stepped back, arms folded.
"Does this mean I can cut my hair too?"
Ellen paused just briefly.
"You're always free to do what you want, Vin. But I kind of think it's pretty longer."
"It stays, then."
"Anyway," Ellen said, "you approve?"
"Definitely," Vin said. "You look like a king."
Though she suspected a part of her would miss the tangle-haired, disheveled Ellen. There had been something endearing about that mixture of earnest competence and distracted inattention.
"Good," Ellen said, "because I think we're going to need the advantage. A messenger just..."
He trailed off, looking over her stacks of paper. "Vin?
Were you doing research?"
Vin flushed.
"I was just looking through the logbook, trying to find references to the deepness."
"You were!"
Ellen stepped forward excitedly. To her chagrin, he quickly located the paper with her fledgling notes on it. He held the paper up, then looked over at her.
"Did you write this?"
"Yes," she said.
"Your penmanship is beautiful," he said, sounding a bit surprised. "Why didn't you tell me you could write like this?"
"Didn't you say something about a messenger?"
Ellen put the sheet back down, looking oddly like a proud parent.
"Right. A messenger from my father's army has arrived. I'm making him wait for a bit. It didn't seem wise to appear too eager. But we should probably go meet with him."
Vin nodded, waving to Orsir. The Chandra rose and padded to her side, and the three of them left her quarters. That was one nice thing about books and notes. They could always wait for another time. They found the messenger waiting in the third-floor venture atrium. Vin and Ellen walked in, and she stopped immediately.
It was him. The Watcher. Helland stepped forward to meet the man, and Vin grabbed his arm.
Wait, she hissed quietly.
Helland turned, confused.
If that man has Atium, Vin thought with a stab of panic, Helland is dead. We're all dead.
The Watcher stood quietly. He didn't look much like a messenger or courier. He wore all black, even a pair of black gloves. He wore trousers and a silken shirt with no cloak or cape. She remembered that face. It was him.
But, she thought, if he'd wanted to kill Helland, he could have done so already.
The thought frightened her, yet she had to admit it was true.
What?
Helland asked, standing in the doorway with her.
Be careful, she whispered. This is no simple messenger. That man is Mistborn.
Helland paused, frowning. He turned back toward the Watcher, who stood quietly, clasping his hands behind his back, looking confident. Yes, he was Mistborn. Only a man such as he could walk into an enemy palace completely surrounded by guards and not be the slightest bit unsettled.
All right, Helland said, finally stepping into the room. Straff's man. You bring a message for me?
Not just a message, Your Majesty, the Watcher said. My name is Zane, and I am something of an ambassador. Your father was very pleased to receive your invitation for an alliance. He's glad that you are finally seeing reason.
Vin studied the Watcher, this Zane. What was his game? Why come himself? Why reveal who he was? Helland nodded, keeping a distance from Zane.
Two armies, Helland said, camped outside my door. Well, that's not the kind of thing I can ignore. I'd like to meet with my father and discuss possibilities for the future.
I think he would enjoy that, Zane said. It has been some time since he saw you, and he has long regretted your falling out. You are, after all, his only son.
It's been hard on both of us, Helland said. Perhaps we could set up a tent in which to meet outside the city?
I'm afraid that won't be possible, Zane said. His Majesty rightly fears assassins. If you wish to speak with him, he'd be happy to host you at his tent in the Venture Camp.
Helland frowned. No, I don't think that makes much sense. If he fears assassins, shouldn't I?
I am certain he could protect you in his own camp, Your Majesty, Zane said. You have nothing to fear from Set's assassins there.
I see, Helland said.
I'm afraid that His Majesty was quite firm on this point, Zane said. You are the one who is eager for an alliance. If you wish a meeting, you will have to come to him.
Helland glanced at Vin. She continued to watch Zane. The man met her eyes and spoke.
I have heard reports of the beautiful Mistborn who accompanies the Venture Heir. She who slew the Lord Ruler and was trained by the survivor himself.
There was silence in the room for a moment. Helland finally spoke.
Tell my father that I will consider his offer.
Zane finally turned away from Vin.
His Majesty was hoping for us to set a date and time, Your Majesty.
I will send another message when I have made my decision, Helland said.
Very well, Zane said, bowing slightly, though he used the move to catch Vin's eyes once again. Then he nodded once to Helland and let the guards escort him away. In the cold mist of early evening, Vin waited on the short wall of Keep Venture, Orsieur sitting at her side. The mists were quiet. Her thoughts were far less serene.
Who else would he work for, she thought. Of course he's one of Straff's men.
That explained many things.
It had been quite a while since their last encounter. Vin had begun to think that she wouldn't see the Watcher again. Would they spar again, then? Vin tried to suppress her eagerness, tried to tell herself that she simply wanted to find this Watcher because of the threat he posed. But the thrill of another fight in the mists, another chance to test her abilities against a Mistborn, made her tense with anticipation. She didn't know him, and she certainly didn't trust him. That only made the prospect of a fight all the more exciting.
"Why are we waiting here, Mistress?" Orsior asked.
"We're just on patrol," Vin said. "Watching for assassins or spies, just like every night."
"Do you command me to believe you, Mistress?"
Vin shot him a flat stare.
"Believe as you wish, Khandra." "Very well," Orsior said. "Why did you not tell the king that you've been sparring with this Zane?"
Vin turned back toward the dark mists.
"Assassins and allomancers are my concern, not Ellen's. No need to worry him yet. He has enough troubles at the moment."
Orsier sat back on his haunches.
"I see.
You don't believe I'm right?"
"I believe as I wish," Orsier said. "Isn't that what you just commanded me, Mistress?"
"Whatever," Vin said. Her bronze was on, and she had to try very hard not to think about the mist spirit. She could feel it waiting in the darkness to her right. She didn't look toward it.
"The logbook never did mention what became of that spirit. It nearly killed one of the hero's companions. After that, there was barely a mention of it."
Problems for another night, she thought, as another source of allomancy appeared to her bronze senses. A stronger, more familiar source.